Oh, hey. Hi there. Didn't see you. Welcome to the Classic English Literature Podcast, a show about the greatest hits of English lit, with a few deep cuts thrown in to make you buy the new album. This is episode 4, All Who Wander, the Anglo-Saxon Elegies. Remember to like and follow the podcast on the Instatwit book pages, and you can email me at classicenglishliterature@gmail.com. I was making my way home the other day when I pulled up behind a Jeep at a stoplight. The spare wheel, had a cover depicting a compass and the reminder, "Not all those who wander are lost." The hobbits in the audience will recognize that line from a poem the wizard Gandalf recites in J.R.R. Tolkien's The Lord of the Rings. But I bring up this otherwise utterly unimportant vignette for a couple of reasons, only one of which, unfortunately, is related to today's poems. Firstly, and cynically, I don't really imagine the driver of the Jeep was romantically and dreamily wandering the byways of my small provincial city. It's probably far more likely she was on her way to Panera for a salad. Secondly, despite the Jeep's towering suspension, its massive mud tires, and a hood snorkel, has anyone ever used those things in real life? I don't believe the owner uses it to wander much at all. There wasn't a scratch on the paint, there wasn't a smear of mud, not a sign, in short, that this Jeep had ever been off-road, had ever wandered beyond the asphalt lanes prescribed and maintained by the local highway department. It has a quite macho aesthetic, but this Jeep and its driver have never been on safari. They've never struck across the desert on a geological expedition, and they've never discovered the lost city of where do you call it. Which brings me to the third point in this increasingly desultory digression. Can you digress before you've even started? I should look that up. Anyway, can one even get lost anymore? I'd be willing to bet my last donut that the Jeep had a satellite navigation system or that the driver had some similar app on her phone. I'll wager that last rainbow sprinkled that this driver has not only rarely wandered, but has, in fact, never been lost. Google has mapped the world. Getting actually physically lost is nearly impossible in the 21st century. We only use the word lost in this sense metaphorically, as in being confused about something, like I'm totally lost about this Jeep story. We may lose our tempers, lose a game, or be at a loss for words, but it's increasingly difficult to get lost in the world. We've looked the whole thing over with our satellite cameras, and we found no dragons at the edges. In fact, we found no edges. Which finally brings me to today's poems. They are two elegies from the Exeter book called The Wanderer, now you've twigged the connection, and The Seafarer. I think they have a really useful link to Beowulf's funeral and its cultural significance that we spoke about in our last episode. So first, let's deal with the definition. An elegy is a poem that laments the passing away of a glorious period, a golden age. And this lamentation is usually occasioned by the death of someone close. You may notice that the word elegy sounds a bit like the word eulogy, which is a speech that someone gives at a funeral. The words are related. In both of today's poems, the speaker, or speakers, are prompted to ruminate about the changeability of the world because they have lost their lord, their war leader. And I do use the verb lost advisedly here, not only as a euphemism for death, but also in that the speaker cannot find his way back to some essential connection that gave meaning to his life. That there's something new he needs to find. So let's look at the first poem, the one called The Wanderer. I'm using the Burton Raffle translation here. This lonely traveler longs for grace, for the mercy of God. Grief hangs on his heart and follows the frost-cold foam he cuts in the sea, sailing endlessly, aimlessly in exile. Fate has opened a single port, memory. He sees his kinsmen slaughtered again and cries, I've drunk too many lonely dawns, gray with mourning. Once there were men to whom my heart could hurry, hot with open longing. They're long since dead. My heart has closed on itself, quietly learning that silence is noble and sorrow nothing that speech can cure. Sadness has never driven sadness off. Fate blows hardest on a bleeding heart. So those who thirst for glory smother secret weakness and longing, neither weep nor sigh nor listen to the sickness in their souls. So I, lost and homeless, forced to flee the darkness that fell on the earth and my Lord. Leaving everything. Weary with winter, I wandered out on the frozen waves, hoping to find a place, a people, a Lord to replace my lost ones. No one knew me now. No one offered comfort, allowed me feasting or joy. How cruel a journey I've traveled, sharing my bread with sorrow alone, an exile in every land. Could only be told by telling my footsteps, for who can hear friendless and poor and know what I've known since the long cheerful nights when, young and yearning, with my Lord I yet feasted most welcome of all. That warmth is dead. He only knows who needs his Lord as I do, eager or long missing aid. He only knows who never sleeps without the deepest dreams of longing. Sometimes it seems I see my Lord, kiss and embrace him, bend my hands and head to his knee, kneeling as though he still sat enthroned, ruling his thanes. And I open my eyes, embracing the air, and I see the brown sea billows heave, see the seabirds bathe, spreading their white feathered wings. Watch the frost and the hail and the snow. And heavy in heart I long for my Lord, alone and unloved. Sometimes it seems I see my kin and greet them gladly, give them welcome, the best of friends. They fade away, swimming soundlessly out of sight. Leaving nothing. How loathsome become the frozen waves to a weary heart. In this brief world, I cannot wonder that my mind is set on melancholy, because I never forget the fate of men, robbed of their riches, suddenly looted by death, the doom of earth sent to us all by ever-rising sun. Wisdom is slow and comes but late. He who has it is patient. He cannot be hasty to hate or speak. He must be bold and yet not blind, never too craven, complacent or covetous, nor ready to gloat before he wins glory. The man's a fool who flings his boasts hotly to the heavens, heeding his spleen and not the better boldness of knowledge. What knowing man knows not the ghostly, waste-like end of worldly wealth? See, already the wreckage is there. The windswept walls stand far and wide, the storm-beaten blocks besmeared with frost, the mead halls crumbled, the monarchs thrown down and stripped of their pleasures. The proudest of warriors now lie by the wall, some of them war-destroyed, some the monstrous seabird bore over the ocean, to some the old wolf dealt out death. And for some dejected followers fashioned an earth cave coffin. Thus, the maker of men lays waste this earth, crushing our callow mirth, and the work of old giant stands weathered and still. He who these ruins rightly sees, and deeply considers this dark, twisted life, who sagely remembers the endless slaughters of a bloody past, is bound to proclaim, "Where is the war steed? Where is the warrior? Where is his warlord? Where now the feasting places? Where now the mead hall pleasures? Alas, bright cup! Alas, brave knight! Alas, you glorious princes, all gone, lost in the night, as you had never lived. And all that survives you, a serpentine wall, wondrously high, worked in strange ways. Mighty spears have slain these men, greedy weapons have framed their fate. These rocky slopes are beaten by storms, this earth pinned down by driving snow, by the horror of winter, smothering warmth in the shadows of night. And the north angrily hurls its hailstones at our helpless heads. Everything earthly is evilly born, firmly clutched by a fickle fate. Fortune vanishes. Friendship vanishes. Man is fleeting. Woman is fleeting. And all this earth rolls into emptiness." So says the sage in his heart, sitting alone with his thought. "It's good to guard your faith, nor let your grief come forth until it cannot call for help, nor help but heed the path you've placed before it. It's good to find your grace in God, the heavenly rock where rests our every hope." There's a lot going on in this poem, so let me focus on one big overarching question. How many speakers do we hear? This has been a matter of some scholarly debate, but let me ballpark it for you. The issue mostly stems from the fact that the first 7 lines seem to function as a prologue. The lonely traveler is introduced. We are told that he is longing for mercy, that he's plagued by memory, and then we hear him actually speak on line 8. So, okay, easy enough. 2 speakers. Some kind of narrator and the wanderer himself. The opening line set up a mystery. Why is the wanderer longing for grace and God's mercy? We're told in line 5 that he is in exile. Is that some kind of criminal sentence? Has he been banished from the Posse Comitatus for failing to protect or avenge his lord? Line 7 says that his kinsmen have been slaughtered. Maybe it's a penance imposed by a priest for reconciliation. Or maybe the wanderer has condemned himself to exile. It's difficult to say because the wanderer's speech, which really spans the bulk of the poem, is not forthcoming with such details. He says in line 21 that he has been, quote, "forced to flee the darkness that fell." But that could be taken either literally or figuratively. And he also articulates an almost stoic belief that, quote, "silence is noble and sorrow nothing that speech can cure." So that may indicate a self-imposed banishment. At any rate, we do know what he initially hopes to find in his exile. Quote, "a place, a people, a lord to replace my lost ones." Now here's where things get a bit interesting. That third stanza, or verse paragraph, begins and ends with 2 fragmentary lines, quote, "leaving everything," and quote, "leaving nothing." In between, we have a catalog of his bereavement, his yearning for the physical presence of his dead lord. When he says that he left everything to go into exile, I don't quite believe him. Not that I think he's lying, but clearly he still has many attachments, emotionally and mentally. There are things he hasn't let go. He focuses on loss, the passing of that glorious time. He is, at this point, and understandably, focused on the disruption to his accustomed way of life and to the values, the rituals, the behaviors that gave it significance, that gave it meaning. Now, I know I'm playing word games a bit here, because the final fragmentary line, quote, leaving nothing, grammatically it refers to the dissolving visions of his kin. He's seeing their ghosts, maybe. But I like to think of the phrase as also a bit of a realization. I like the way that it might work in a parallel fashion to the first fragment phrase. He's realized that he has lost everything, but hasn't been able to leave it behind. He has psychologically left nothing. Because then we get a really interesting little adjective to describe the world. He says it's brief. The world and human life in it is temporary, evanescent. All things must pass, as another great English poet sang to us once. The wanderer's perception begins to shift. He tells us that, quote, wisdom is slow and comes but late, and that what knowing man knows not the ghostly, waste-like end of worldly wealth. The alliteration is particularly effective in these lines. He notes the wreckage around him, the windswept halls, the storm-beaten blocks, the mead halls crumbled. He says, quote, the maker of men lays waste this earth. God crushes worldly ambitions. And just as in Beowulf, we have a very Old Testament Hebrew scripture vision of God. God in Anglo-Saxon poetry is a god of power and justice and wrath, much more than a god of mercy, like we would think of maybe in the Christian scripture or the New Testament. To realize that human works will be withered is the start of wisdom, so says the wanderer. And then he moves into one of the key formal elements of the Anglo-Saxon elegy. It's called the Ubi Sunt passage. Ubi Sunt is Latin for where are. And this is the point in the poem when the speaker asks, where are the great things of the past? What happened to the good old days? Where have they gone? The war steeds, the warriors, the feasting places, the mead hall pleasures, the bright cup, the brave knight, the glorious princes, all gone. To yearn for these is folly. For as he says, quote, fortune vanishes, friendship vanishes, man is fleeting, woman is fleeting, and all this earth rolls into emptiness. There are some really vibrant echoes here of the book Ecclesiastes, which is one of the Hebrew wisdom books in the Bible. The vanity, the futility of all things. There's no sense of salvation. There's no purpose. There's no, as Aristotle would say, there's no telos, or end goal, to all of this. Then, we seem to get an epilogue in the last five or six lines. Quote, so says the sage in his heart. Again, like Ecclesiastes, but who is the sage in the wanderer? Is it the wanderer himself? Is it the narrator that seems to be present at the beginning? This question of how many speakers is quite vexing because it's difficult to know whether or not the wanderer character has really experienced any enlightenment or has really figured out what to do. He may be just an example of human failure and restlessness that this sage character points out to us as a caveat. The wanderer suffers because he's a fool. Look at him, says the sage, and listen to what he says. Or does the wanderer come to some understanding of the world's transient betrayal, and the epilogue is the sage's approval of his growth? You know, like Yoda approves of Luke Skywalker's tumbling abilities on Dagobah. Or again, and this is the one that I like, there is only the wanderer, alone and self-regarding. He reflects as a sage on his own life, as a wanderer. And he ends the poem by saying, it's good to find your grace in God, the heavenly rock where rests our every hope. I find the end of the poem unsatisfying, though, because he doesn't say, I have found my grace in God, or I know how to find my grace in God. He just says, it sure would be good. the God thing feels tacked on, which is why some scholars argue that maybe the beginning and the ending of The Wanderer are later Christian additions to an earlier and probably pagan work. You know, maybe that's why we've got this discrepancy about speakers. Because for all the misery and the near nihilism of the main monologue, the epilogue says, trust in God. And it feels trite, you know, if dismissive even. You know, it makes me think of like, you know, you're at a funeral and, you know, you're grieving and you're just, oh, you're all tore up. You can't see a future without the person who has just died. And then someone comes up to you and says, well, it was God's will. Just makes me want to blast them in the face, you know? I mean, they mean well, I guess. But it's at least tone deaf, if not completely disrespectful, disregarding. Which is why I'm following in the footsteps of many teachers over many decades by pairing The Wanderer with another famous Anglo-Saxon elegy, The Seafarer. Similar setup to the last poem, but this time we're out on the North Sea. This tale is true and mine. It tells how the sea took me, swept me back and forth in sorrow and fear and pain, showed me suffering in 100 ships, in 1,000 ports, and in me. It tells of smashing surf when I sweated in the cold of an anxious watch, perched in the bow as it dashed under cliffs. My feet were cast in icy bands, bound with frost, with frozen chains, and hardship groaned around my heart. Hunger tore at my sea-weary soul. No man sheltered on the quiet fairness of earth can feel how wretched I was, drifting through winter on an ice-cold sea, whirled in sorrow, alone in a world blown clear of love, hung with icicles. The hailstorms flew. The only sound was the roaring sea, the freezing waves. The song of the swan might serve for pleasure, the cry of the sea fowl, the death noise of birds instead of laughter, the mewing of gulls instead of mead. Storms beat on the rocky cliffs and were echoed by icy feathered terns and the eagle's screams. No kinsman could offer comfort there to a soul left drowning in desolation. And who could believe, knowing but the passion of cities, swelled proud with wine and no taste of misfortune, how often, how wearily, I put myself back on the paths of the sea. Night would blacken, it would snow from the north, frost bound the earth, and hail would fall, the coldest seas. And how my heart would begin to beat, knowing once more the salt waves tossing and the towering sea. The time for journeys would come, and my soul called me eagerly out, sent me over the horizon seeking foreigners' homes. But there isn't a man on earth so proud, so born to greatness, so bold with his youth, grown so brave or so graced by God, that he feels no fear as the sails unfurl, wondering what fate has willed and will do. No harps ring in his heart, no rewards, no passion for women, no worldly pleasures, nothing, only the ocean's heave. Longing wraps itself around him. Orchards blossom, the towns bloom. Fields grow lovely as the world springs fresh. And all these admonish that willing mind, leaping to journeys, always set in thoughts traveling on a quickening tide. So summer's sentinel, the cuckoo, sings in his murmuring voice, and our hearts mourn as he urges. Who could understand, in ignorant ease, what we others suffer as the paths of exile stretch endlessly on? And yet my heart wanders away. My soul roams with the sea, the whale's home, wandering to the widest corners of the world, returning ravenous with desire, flying solitary, screaming, exciting me to the open ocean, breaking oaths on the curve of a wave. Thus the joys of God are fervent with life, where life itself fades quickly into the earth. The wealth of the world neither reaches to heaven nor remains. No man has ever faced the dawn, certain which of fate's three threats would fall: illness, or age, or an enemy's sword, snatching the life from his soul. The praise the living pour on the dead flowers from reputation. Plant an earthly life of profit reaped even from hatred and rancor, of bravery flung in the devil's face, and death can only bring earthly praise and a song to celebrate a place with the angels, life eternally blessed in the hosts of heaven. The days are gone when the kingdoms of earth flourished in glory. Now there are no rulers, no emperors, no givers of gold as once there were, when wonderful things were worked among them and they lived in lordly magnificence. Those powers have vanished. Those pleasures are dead. The weakest survives and the world continues, kept spinning by toil. All glory is tarnished. The world's honor ages and shrinks, bent like the men who would mold it. Their faces blanch as time advances, their beards wither, and they mourn the memory of friends. The sons of princes sown in the dust. The soul, stripped of its flesh, knows nothing of sweetness or sour, feels no pain, bends neither its hand nor its brain. A brother opens his palms and pours down gold on his kinsman's grave, strewing his coffin with treasures intended for heaven. But nothing golden shakes the wrath of God for a soul overflowing with sin. Nothing hidden on earth rises to heaven. We all fear God. He turns the earth. He set it swinging firmly in place. Gave life to the world and light to the sky. Death leaps at fools who forget their God. He who lives humbly has angels from heaven to carry him courage and strength and belief. A man must conquer pride, not kill it. Be firm with his fellows, chaste for himself. Treat all the world as the world deserves, with love or with hate, but never with harm. Though an enemy seek to scorch him in hell or set the flames of a funeral pyre under his lord. Fate is stronger and God mightier than any man's mind. Our thoughts should turn to where our home is. Consider the ways of coming there, and then strive for sure permission for us to rise to that eternal joy, that life born in the love of God and the hope of heaven. Praise the holy grace of him who honored us, eternal, unchanging, creator of earth. Amen. There is no ambiguity about the speaker here. The seafarer asserts his own experience, the meaning he has assigned it, and his possession of both. First line, out of the gate, this tale is true and mine. Asserting authority. Boom. And then we get a lengthy description of the sea, not so much as a setting, although it is that, but as a phenomenon, that is, an experience with significance. The seafarer personifies the sea. It, quote, takes him. It sweeps him back and forth in sorrow and pain. It shows him suffering. Just thought of this. The sea kind of seems like a sage here, like a demonstrator of wisdom. I'll have to think about that some more. What we do have is the poet invoking a very old interpretation of the sea as chaos, as ultimate disorder. Now, this is what we call in the trade an archetypal symbol. An archetype, or archetypal symbol, is a symbol that is transcultural and transhistorical. Is that clear? No? Well, what I mean is that it's a symbol that would have roughly the same meaning to any culture on Earth at any time. Some symbols are really bound to a certain time and place. Like, take a Valentine heart. We know nowadays in modern Western culture that a Valentine heart is a symbol for love. But if we hopped in our DeLorean, fired up the flux capacitor, and raced off to ancient Egypt at 88 miles an hour, they wouldn't have a clue what that symbol was supposed to mean. But if we said, we think the sea is a symbol of chaos, they'd be totally on with it. In fact, the opening lines of the Bible talk about the sea that way. Quote, "In the beginning, when God created the heavens and the earth was a formless void, and the darkness covered the face of the deep, while a wind from God swept over the face of the waters." So creation here is shaping order out of chaos, and that chaos is the void of the deep waters. And the Babylonian creation myth, which is called the Enuma Elish, and it's a lot of scholars think it was a major influence, in fact, on the Genesis story, it personifies the sea as the goddess Tiamat, the chaos of primordial creation that has to be conquered by the god Marduk so that order can be established and civilization begin. And you can see this use of the sea in cultures all over the world throughout time. Which is all to say that the poet of the seafarer is dealing with some heavy-duty symbolism with a quite distinguished pedigree. I've always been interested in another symbolic move the poet makes in line 8. He says, quote, "My feet were cast in icy bands, bound with frost, with frozen chains." Now, usually you'd see this, as the language clearly suggests, as a symbol of bondage, of imprisonment, of restriction. You know, he's cast in icy bands, he's bound with frost and chains, you know. And ice is often seen as a symbol of stasis, the inability to move, the inability to progress. Dante, in his poem The Inferno, the first part of the Divine Comedy, famously casts the lowest reaches of hell as ice, you know, where Satan resides is ice. And so those kind of things make sense here in the seafarer. He's wandering the ocean in the winter. He's miserable. He's literally frozen to his ship, a prisoner. But what makes it interesting is its link with something he says a bit later. Quote, "And who could believe how often, how wearily, I put myself back on the paths of the sea?" I think that's really mind-blowing. He's doing this to himself. He puts himself back out onto the sea. He's not just an object that the sea is toying with, knocking him around. He's compelled by something deep inside him. He's obsessed with finding something. He's bound to do so. There's a hunger he can't satisfy. And we've got a very different situation than in The Wanderer. There, the wanderer is in exile under some kind of punishment, perhaps. He's been cast away. But the seafarer casts himself away. He's responding to some deep psychological need that civilized life on land can't satisfy. And he's afraid of it. He says there's no one so great and bold that he, quote, "feels no fear as the sails unfurl." He's asking questions, but he's afraid of the answers. This guy's got an inner life. This guy's got a personality, psychological complexity. We don't see that kind of stuff very often in ancient literatures. I wonder if this fear is rooted in a dissatisfaction with the answers he's been given by his tradition. You know, like the wanderer, he realizes that, quote, "the wealth of the world neither reaches to heaven nor remains." You know, you can't take it with you. But the seafarer goes further and questions the very base of pagan heroism and immortality. He says, quote, "the praise the living pour on the dead flowers from reputation. Plant an earthly life of profit reaped even from hatred and rancor, of bravery flung in the devil's face, and death can only bring you earthly praise and a song to celebrate a place with the angels, life eternally blessed in the hosts of heaven." For traditional Germanic warrior cultures, there is no heaven after death. Not in the way that we, who might be familiar with the Christian tradition, imagine it. Rather, immortality came from living memory. The glory you earned in life kept you alive in the songs of the Shops. That's why back in Beowulf, that's why Beowulf mocks Unferth. He says, I've not heard any great things about you. When he says that, that's condemnation. It's not snark. He's not being a wise guy. He's pointing out that you haven't done anything great enough for anyone to sing about. And it's the same reason Beowulf asks for a monument at his own death. He needs to be remembered if he is to be immortal. But in The Seafarer, the speaker seems kind of ambivalent about that idea. He doesn't reject it. But when he says glory can, quote, only bring earthly praise, he seems to be emphasizing a desire for a more substantial afterlife. Now, he reinforces this with his own ubi sunt passage. Where are the kingdoms of earth, the rulers, the emperors, the givers of gold? Kenning alert. Power vanishes, pleasure dies. He says, quote, all glory is tarnished. And then we get what I think is the most significant passage, culturally speaking, in the Anglo-Saxon elegies. The seafarer declares a new morality. Not one based on comitatus, glory, and courage, but one based on humility, compassion, and meekness. He says, quote, he who lives humbly has angels from heaven to carry him courage and strength and belief. A man must conquer pride, not kill it, be firm with his fellows, chaste for himself, treat all the world as the world deserves, with love or with hate, but never with harm. This is an entire repudiation of Beowulf's ethic. Here, courage and strength come from God, not from within, not from ourselves. One must be humble, fair-minded, modest, and gentle. We do not get this from Beowulf's boasts when he first arrives at Heorot. The seafarer is moving from a Germanic ethic to a Christian one. This is a huge shift in Anglophonic culture. There had been Christian missions to the Anglo-Saxons going back to the year 597 with St. Augustine of Canterbury. But now, perhaps by the turn of the millennium, it seems to have fully seeped into the cultural system. Paganism is on the wane. The seafarer ends his poem by urging action, not wallowing in anxiety or doubt. He says, quote, our thoughts should turn to where our home is. The wanderer has realized this too, but the seafarer adds, quote, consider the ways of coming there. Home, of course, is heaven. And the way to get there is to embrace an entirely different set of values and live according to them in order to, quote, rise to that eternal joy. The last word of the poem is amen. The seafarer ends as a prayer, a gesture of hope, and not an acquiescence to fate. I think this poem is crucial for understanding the major swerve in English culture and history. At this point in history, like I said, maybe around the millennium, England could have gone two ways. It could have held on to the Scandinavian world, where it had its cultural roots, the Danes, the Norse, those pagan warrior societies. Or it could have set its sights south, to mainland Europe and Christendom. Obviously, it went with the latter, and history has played out the consequences. But this poem sits on the fault line of that decision, at that fork in the road. The other thing I like about this poem is that it reconceives human life as a pilgrimage. Now, a pilgrimage is a religiously inspired journey. And pilgrimage will become the dominant metaphor for human life for the rest of the Middle Ages. In fact, it's still with us. You know, how many times have you heard the cliche that life is a journey? Too many, for my taste. Nowadays, we've just secularized the metaphor. But it's a metaphor that helps us deal with the greatest anxiety of human existence, change. what I've called mutability in this podcast. It's the thing we're most afraid of. I think we long for stability. We long for predictability. Think about it. We buy insurance. We invest and start savings accounts. We exercise. We get educated. All in an effort to control or absorb the possibility of negative change. When the seafarer speaks of eternity, this is what he means. Now, we tend to think of eternity as endless time. You know, the timeline starts at a certain point and just goes on forever. But that's not really what some philosophers and theologians mean. What they mean, and what I think the seafarer means too, is that eternity isn't endless time, but the opposite of time. The antonym of time. That space where time no longer obtains, where there is no flux, where all is immutable and stable, free from the pressures of FOMO or YOLO or carpe diem, unchanging. So to tie these last two episodes together, remember last time I said that the monk transcribing Beowulf had a great respect for his protagonist and the culture he represented, but thought that they were insufficient? You know, Beowulf was the greatest hero, but he's gone. His time passed. I think the Wanderer thinks so too. The Wanderer keeps looking for another earthly lord to follow in that comitatus bond that held the Germanic culture together. But they're insufficient. And so if these are the diagnosis of the problem of mutability, then the seafarer is the prescription. The seafarer says, look for a heavenly lord, one who does not die, one who is unchanging. Essentially, replace Beowulf with Jesus. Wow. Phew. Remember to like and follow the Classic English Literature podcast on the Instatwit book. Email me at classicenglishliterature@gmail.com. Please, please like and subscribe on your favorite podcatcher. I'd be ever so humbled by positive comments and reviews, and they'll help other people discover the podcast too. Next time, we'll start moving into what are sometimes called the High Middle Ages. We'll talk about the conquest by Norman and all the changes he wrought. Till then, good luck, everybody.